The next case is Robert Berry versus Javich Block and Rathbone. Good morning, Mr. Sinnenberg. You may proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice Brown. May it please the court, my name is Roger Sinnenberg. I represent the appellant, Javich Block and Rathbone, in this case, and I would respectfully request that I be permitted 3 minutes for rebuttal.
You may, and before you proceed, just wanted to mention that Judge Jeff Froelich has joined this panel in place of Justice O'Connor. Judge Froelich comes from the Second District Court of Appeals. You may proceed.
Thank you. The law in the state of Ohio is well settled. In the settlement of a tort claim for damages, a release obtained by fraud in the inducement is voidable, and before a subsequent cause of action can be maintained, the releaser must rescind the release and tender back the consideration. This has been established in a line of cases starting with Picklesheimer and Schallenberger and Haller, which govern the rights and remedies that are available to a releaser who is claiming fraud in the inducement. In this case, the settlement agreement unequivocally provided for contingent release upon one of two events. The first event was a judgment satisfied by Legent, and the second event was the claim against Legent for that judgment was otherwise resolved. In this case, the claim was otherwise resolved. Both the Javich firm and the appellee in this case filed lawsuits against Legent. In Javich's lawsuit, a motion for summary judgment was granted in favor of Legion, and the case was appealed, and Legion was successful.
Excuse me, counsel. Was there a release? Or are you saying there was a release as a matter of law?
I'm saying there was a contingent release as a matter of law upon the satisfaction of one of two.
Well, it was a contingent release as a matter of law.
It was.
Did it become a release?
It became a release upon the case against Legion being otherwise resolved.
Didn't Javich's lawyer at one time write to plaintiff's counsel requesting that they prepare a release?
Yes, that was done in October of 01, but that was done, as the lawyer testified, Mr. Herman, in his deposition. He was filing a lawsuit. He anticipated filing a lawsuit against the agent for having neglected to make sure that there was either a tail or otherwise coverage. It was he testified that when he sent that letter to Legion's attorneys, that he did so without knowledge of anybody at the Javich Law Firm, and they all testified that they had no knowledge. It was just an act by a lawyer to attempt to get coverage at a time that he knew that Clarendon was not going to provide coverage. It was a letter. It was not done with the acquiescence of Javich, and everybody who was involved testified to that. So it is of very little evidentiary consequence in this case. So our position is that the Court of Appeals, in applying the Frederickson case and allowing an election of remedies in this case, was clearly in error, because the Picklesheimer cases clearly provide that you must have a rescission and you must have a tender back of consideration. And as is set forth in the Schallenberger case, it explains the difference between a release where there's a tangible good and there's a release where there's a tort claim for damages. So to allow an election like the Court of Appeals suggests in this case would allow the releaser to retain the benefit of the release at the same time as attacking the validity of the release.
Then is that your strongest position, Mr. Sinnenberg, that there was no tender back of the $65,000 in this case?
Correct, Your Honor. Not only that, the settlement agreement provided that under no circumstances would the Javich firm be required to pay more than $65,000. But both the tender back doctrine, Your Honor, and the failure to rescind, the only option available when there's a tort claim for damages and a claim for fraud in the inducement is to go by the vehicle of a 60B and also make a showing that the ends of justice would best be served by allowing the clients by allowing the movement to proceed under the 60B.
And your position is because they failed to tender the $65,000 back, they're precluded from any relief?
Yes, sir. They're not precluded from any relief. They're precluded except to go under 60B. In this circumstance, they don't satisfy the requirements of 60B because they filed it longer than 1 year out.
So they have no relief?
So they have no relief. And it's and public policy demands that to be the case because there has to be some finality.
What if there were some actual fraud, and I'm not saying that happened in this case, but some actual overt fraud on the part of the releasee that was able to be concealed for more than a year?
Well, and the law provides relief for that. Yes, absolutely. Schallenberger talks about if it's – you're talking about a void, a situation where there's been deceit or trickery or lack of capacity, which would make the release void.
Deceit and trickery are different than fraud?
No. Well, the courts have – yes, there's different types of fraud. Deceit, trickery, lack of capacity, such as Schallenberger, where they were – where the plaintiff was said, sign this document – it does, you know, don't bother reading it. Just sign this document, which was a release of all possible claims, which involved deceit and trickery. Where there's fraud in the inducement, such as in this case, it's clear that it's a voidable contract. And where it's a voidable contract, the law is clear in this case, in this state rather, that there must be a rescission and there must be a tender back.
But that's my question. If there's fraud in the inducement, active fraud, they conceal a witness, they actively lie about how much assets they have, such as in the Summa case, and it goes beyond a year, then the plaintiff is left without a remedy because 60B3 is no longer available?
Correct. And public policy demands that because think for a moment, if you were allowed, if a contract was voidable in the deceit in the situation you talk about, Judge, then every party in every case would be required to have contingent liability on the book, basically for an undetermined amount of time, because fraud is an action when it's discovered or should be discovered. And like in this case, it was discovered last year. There has to be some finality.
Isn't the defendant rewarded for his nefarious actions?
Well, the argument could be made that the defendant's rewarded, but there has to be a balancing here of public policy versus that person. And understand, if the conduct is so egregious, like it was in Schallenberg, where it's deceitful or by trick, then you still have a remedy to void the contract, not rescind it, not tender back, and pursue on with your claim for fraud.
And relitigate the underlying malpractice in this case?
And relitigate the underlying malpractice case.
I have a practical question on tendering back. If we accept your proposition, do you tender it back to the other party, or do you plead it into court and the court holds it? What is the process?
Well, I think that's a good question, Your Honor, and I think the careful part would probably be on a party to tender it back would be to represent it as pleading that it's either been put in a trust account or it's been put in his attorney's IOLTA account. But I think there has to be an actual tender back. It just couldn't be enough to allege that I will tender back or to suggest that they have in some fashion.
Because you could have a tender back and give the money back to the original party and then they take off and now you have no remedy, correct?
Well, you could ask the court for relief to put it in a trust. And let the court.
If you tender it back and then you try your case and you lose your case, do you get the settlement monies back?
Would the releasee get the settlement money back? That would be up to the court, but I would imagine the court in that circumstance would give it to the plaintiff.
If you can show if the party being sued on the settlement can show there was no fraud, the settlement was valid. Is the settlement affirmed and the money given back to the other party?
Yes. Everybody would take the position they had before the subsequent lawsuit was filed in that case. But there has to be a tender back. The law is clear on that because if you were allowed to elect in circumstances such as this without tendering back, then you would get the benefit of the bargain, be allowed to attack the validity of the release, and essentially ignore the consent judgment entry in the case. And I think that the law is well settled on this. I think in this case, our Court of Appeals just made an error in selecting the Fredrickson case where there was not a tangible tort claim such as there was in this.
Let me ask you to assume that there was a release in this case, which, of course, is disputed.
Right.
But how is it... is the other party here attacking the underlying release? Do they want to relitigate the malpractice, or are they affirming the release on the malpractice and bringing a separate cause of action for fraud?
Correct. They're affirming and bringing a separate cause of action for fraud. They're not looking to litigate the original cause of action. They're looking to keep the $65,000 and proceed on a subsequent action without a tender back or a rescission.
Right, for a different tort.
And how could they?
For a different tort.
Yes, sir.
But how could they prove damages if they don't litigate the underlying malpractice and establish an entitlement to damages?
That's a very good question, and the courts have struggled with that over the years and recognized that it would be difficult to identify the damages. But the choices are clear here, and they chose the wrong choice. They should have rescinded the original release and tendered back the $65,000 and proceeded on the original action. And they didn't, and they elected a remedy, and they elected the remedy they elected because by proceeding under 60B, they would have been defeated right out of the box because they didn't comply with the requirement that it be filed within 1 year. So at that point in time, and they knew that it was obvious that, or had to have been obviously, that it wasn't a void release because they were represented by counsel. They were experienced litigators. The plaintiff had been involved in 18 prior cases. So they knew what they were doing, and they had a choice. They had several choices available to them that they did not avail themselves of. Javich asked them when the Legion coverage was turned down for leave so they could file a declaratory judgment, and they opposed that. They testified in their deposition, the Berrys did, that they settled the case because at the time they thought it was in their best interests, and they were informed and made a voluntary and knowing decision to enter into the settlement agreement at the time.
And why isn't Frederickson applicable?
It's inapplicable.
Why isn't it? I'm sorry, sir.
It's inapplicable because Frederickson allows a election of remedies without regard for rescission and a tender back. And Frederickson case involved real estate. This involves a tort claim for damages. Big distinction in that.
I don't understand that distinction.
Well, if you look in the Schallenberger case, this court talked about the difference between a claim for tangible goods or real estate and a tort claim for damages like we have in this case. And they recognize that where there's a real estate claim or a tangible goods claim, that every time possession or custody or ownership of the object at stake is exchanged, that the object diminishes in value, and the same cannot be said for a tort claim for damages like in this case. We're talking just about dollars.
There's no prejudice by delay on the tort claim, analogous to the prejudice of recirculating this real estate?
Well, there wouldn't be the same prejudice that they were likely to suffer if they were allowed election of remedies. Wouldn't that be because you're talking about prejudice accruing from the delay in time?
Well, I don't understand the difference between the real estate and tort. And I'm familiar with Schallenberger and Deepest Sabatino and the Hawaii case and others that have addressed that specific issue. So why is that difference? Why isn't Frederickson controlling?
Well, the way that the court in Schallenberger explained it was a tort claim for damages is readily identifiable by a dollar figure. And the tort claim in Frederickson was with respect to real estate that was being transferred. In Schallenberger, they talked about tangible goods, how they're distinguishable from dollars, because every time a tangible good is transferred ownership, the value of it diminishes. Even if it doesn't diminish, the parties have been inconvenienced and otherwise put to the expense.
Isn't the opposite also true? Why does a piece of real estate diminish every time? It actually could go up in value depending on the market, but the parties in a tort are still inconvenienced and may have a worse case down the road because of witnesses' memories or lack of witnesses or expenses or a million reasons.
That's a possibility, but you're suggesting, Judge, that a voidable contract be treated as a void contract and that the party who perpetuated the fraud should be punished at the same comparable level. I don't know how I could better explain the distinction between real property and tangible goods and a tort claim for damages, as it was done in the Schallenberger case, where the justices agreed that, yes, it could go up in value, but every time goods are used or real estate is used, it affects the value of the property. Whereas when we're talking about a tort claim for damages, we're just talking about dollars. And you're right. I mean, I can't disagree with you that time doesn't serve any of the parties well in any delayed litigation. I'll concede that point. But we're still not. But I will argue that we're not talking about that when we're talking about a tort claim for damages dollar amount.
Thank you.
To affirm the Court of Appeals decision would allow the parties to, would allow the releaser to maintain the benefit of the bargain, attack the validity of the release without any consequences to the releasor, and we would respectfully ask that, and we think that the line of this court in Picklesheimer, Schallenberger, and Haller are the cases that are applicable to the circumstances of this case, and that the Court of Appeals in applying the Fredrickson case did so in error.
Thank you, Mr. Sennenberg.
Thank you.
Mr. Greco.
Chief Justice Brown, may it please the Court. Appellant's proposition of law not only contradicts this Court's longstanding ruling in Fredrickson v. Nye, but also undermines the very basic hallmarks of our judicial system: honesty, candor, and fair dealing. And in an exchange of questioning with Mr. Sinnenberg and Justice Froelich, I think we get to that undermining of our system when we listen to the argument that basically Javich Block is saying, we got a free pass at our fraud here. You didn't file your 60B motion within the 1 year, therefore we get away with the alleged fraud. It's as simple as that. Now,
well, it is simple, but there are lots of meritorious claims that go by or in the ditch because somebody didn't file in the time required.
That's true, Your Honor.
All kinds of claims.
However, this is a unique situation because of the issue we're dealing with. And let me carry on with the issue of the release, because that's obviously a key issue here. And again, as Justice Froelich pointed out, there was a letter by Mr. Herman, not in October of 2001, but April of 2006, indicating, referencing the contemplation of the release in the settlement agreement, and indicating it's come to my attention that that release has not been executed. That was in 2006, while we were well involved in this litigation for fraud. This case does not involve a release. There was no release. A release was contemplated. That's clearly laid out in the settlement agreement. For the contingency release to have been affected in this case, as Mr. Sinnenberg points out, is the Legion judgment would have been satisfied or otherwise resolved. There has been no proof submitted by appellants that the otherwise resolved has in fact taken place, and I would submit to you as a matter of public record, because Legion went into liquidation, there's a proof of claim form pending between the statutory liquidator in Pennsylvania pertaining to the Berry's claim. So it hasn't been otherwise resolved. So I think it's important for this court to understand our position. There was no release in this case. Therefore, Picklesheimer, Haller, Schallenberg do not apply.
If we rule in your favor, how do you prove damages? How do you prove what you should have settled without proving the underlying malpractice?
Good question, Your Honor. We're not seeking more than the $195,000 consent judgment. That was filed. That consent judgment for $195,000 is pending. The damages are very clear. You have the difference between the $195,000 consent judgment and the $65,000 already tendered by Javich Block, $130,000. Those are the fraud-type damages that the court in Fredrickson v. Nye and the other cases.
So if we write case law for all cases and we don't have a consent judgment in the next case, how do we apply this rule to the next case?
Well, I think this rule is very case specific in terms it deals with consent judgment, and the propositional law talks about, the proposed propositional law talks about a consent judgment, a settlement release, and then they throw in the word, or a settlement agreement, and they throw in the word release.
So you would have us limit the ability to sue in fraud and keep the settlement to consent judgment cases?
If I understand your question correctly, Your Honor, we have a consent judgment. That's not in dispute. That judgment is for $195,000. The appellees have never sought anything more than that $195,000. Again, the Picklesmeyer, Haler, Schallenberg.
But you want us to write a rule that allows you to keep the tender or keep the monies, not tender back, and sue for fraud.
Correct. In accordance with.
And if we write a rule like that, how do we get to damages? Your case is easy. The next one may not, but we have to write a rule for more than your. If we write a rule that says you can sue for fraud and keep the damages, do we draw any parameters around it?
I think it would be up then to the trial court in terms of what are the fraud-type damages. You have attorney's fees, punitive damages. And again, if you look at the Ninth District Court of Appeals decision in Summa, I think they talked about it. In that case, which is almost identical to this case, other than in that case there was a release, the court held that the plaintiff in that case didn't have to tender back the $20,000 that they had been awarded. They weren't seeking to go back and relitigate, in that case, a medical malpractice case and start over again. Just like in this case, the Berrys aren't seeking to relitigate the underlying legal malpractice case. To do that, I think, would go in complete opposition to what the appellants are arguing in terms of judicial efficiency and timely matter. That would delay this case even further if we had to go back to square one in 2000 and start relitigating the underlying legal malpractice case.
Counsel, has any court definitively determined whether or not there is a release in this case? I mean, there's the question of the settlement judgment. That's apparently not in dispute, but was there a release, a valid release executed? Has that been determined
by any
court?
Not according to the Court of Appeals for the 8th District. They specifically stated there was no release, and they referenced Mr. Herman's 2006 letter indicating that the contemplated release had not yet been signed. So clearly the 8th District indicated there was no release.
Did the trial court rule on that issue, whether there was a release?
The trial court's ruling granting Javich's motion for summary judgment was a one-sentence opinion, Your Honor, indicating no genuine issues of material fact exist, therefore summary judgment is granted. So I can't answer that.
It's hard to tell.
So
from that,
so this matter is going to have to be litigated further. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor. It is a very simple matter of returning the case to the trial court and allowing the appellees to proceed with their fraud claim for the specified damages, the $130,000 plus the requested punitive damages, fraud-type damages.
Then piggybacking on Justice Cupp's question, would the issue of the validity of the release be called into question at trial?
I think it could be. That would be an issue for the trier of fact to decide whether there was a release, a contingency release, and if it was a contingency release as indicated in the settlement agreement. Again, the settlement agreement calls for a potential release, whether or not those contingencies were met in this case.
Mm-hmm. I don't understand how that's isn't that inconsistent with your previous argument? I thought you were saying there's no release, but even if there is a release, we don't care because it was releasing the malpractice case, and this is a suit for fraud.
You're right, Your Honor, and I apologize if I was unclear. You're absolutely right. We're saying there is no release, but even if there was a release in this case, it doesn't matter. All the cases the appellants cite deal with a release, and then the parties trying to go back and recover more than what they were seeking in that release. Go back to the original malpractice case, personal injury case, what have you, to seek more than what was asked for. And we're not seeking any more than $195,000.
And I understand that's your position, but my question was, when it goes back on remand, if we were to find in your favor. The issue might itself be raised by your opponent.
It may be, but again, the Court of Appeals has already ruled that there was no release in this case. So that would be our
Although
position.
They're not the fact finders.
That's true. That's true.
Thank you.
The appellants in this case, Your Honors, hold their hat on the three cases, Picklesmeyer, Schallenberger, and Haler. Again, it's outlaid in our briefs. Those cases are clearly distinguishable from our case in that we are not seeking to go back and recover more than what the Berrys agreed to in the consent judgment. I think the public policy issue in this case is very important. All the Berrys are asking for is their day in court to determine whether or not they have a valid claim for fraudulent inducement consistent with Frederickson.
Mr. Greco, isn't it inconsistent to say that the Berrys are fine with the provision of the consent judgment as to the $195,000, but not fine as to the limitation to Javich's $65,000, that under no circumstances will Javich pay more than $65,000? How do you explain picking and choosing which parts of the consent will survive that you'll live with?
Your Honor, I think the consent judgment specifically references that the $195,000 was a determination made by both sides as a fair value for the underlying legal malpractice. You then look at, well, how did you decide on the $65,000? And that's where we get into the issue of the fraud. The Berrys were relying upon the alleged fraudulent representations that there was only Legion Insurance here. Legion Insurance is clearly mentioned throughout the settlement agreement. The parties will cooperate in trying to seek coverage from Legion Insurance. Legion Insurance, Legion Insurance. This settlement agreement was executed in December of 2001. We know that in October of 2001, while the underlying legal malpractice case was going on, that Mr. Herman for Javich Black wrote a letter to Clarendon Insurance indicating that we believe there may be coverage, the exact words that we used in our underlying interrogatory, which created the whole basis here for this fraudulent
claim. You're saying then that the allegations of fraud that you want to assert were not a factor in reaching an agreement at 195.
That's correct.
But only with respect to another part of the document, that pertaining to what Javich's portion of payment was going to be.
That's correct, Your Honor. The Berrys were relying upon Javich's representations that they believed there was coverage under Legion. The Berrys accepted that and were willing to, at that point in time, take $65,000 less than the $195,000 because it was reasonable for them to rely upon the representation that there quite possibly be coverage through Legion Insurance. And
so how do we know that the fraud you're alleging did not factor into the $195,000 agreement?
Well, the settlement agreement itself, again, references an amount reasonable to resolve this case, and there's no dispute, and the Berrys have never disputed, that $195,000 was not sufficient. So, again, they're not disputing that judgment, and the consent judgment was filed. It's with regards to the $65,000 where the specific alleged fraudulent conduct comes into play. And that's laid out, too, in terms of the plaintiff's expert report from Mr. Bashine. It was reasonable for the plaintiffs to rely upon the representations that Javich Black had coverage only through Legion.
If we were to rule against you and find that you would have to do a tender back, set aside the statute of limitations problems, what would the process be? Would it be a tender back to a court? Who would get it to be sure that settlement was still available at the end?
Your Honor, I think I would agree with Mr. Sindenberg that perhaps that $65,000 could be held in either our IALTA account or some escrow account overseen by the trial court, perhaps, until a determination is made in that case. But
because you would certainly run the risk that if you gave it back and you had a different party as the other side, they could run off with it.
That's exactly correct. That's why I don't even think we should get to that issue based upon the conduct in this case.
Counsel, I'm not clear on what the status of Claritin Insurance is, whether there was, would have been coverage or would not have been coverage, and what this, whether it's collectible now. Is that all in dispute, or has that been resolved?
Claritin Insurance or Legion Insurance, Your Honor?
Claritin. That's the one that was not disclosed, right?
Correct. What happened, Your Honor, and the way we found out about the Claritin Insurance policy is once Legion went into rehabilitation, we had filed a supplemental petition against Legion, and we were informed that they are now in rehabilitation. You cannot pursue them on a supplemental petition. Given the fact they were in rehabilitation, we then filed a supplemental petition against the Ohio Guarantee Fund seeking the amount of the judgment. Attorneys for the Ohio Guarantee Fund indicated it was not covered, the $195,000 judgment was not covered under the Guarantee Fund for two reasons. Number one, Legion had a legitimate reason for their denial of coverage, but more importantly for our purposes, number two, it indicated it appears as though other insurance wasn't exhausted in this case. That other insurance was a reference to Clarendon Insurance. That's how we discovered it 4 or 5 years later. And again, getting back to Mr. Sinnenberg's point, indicating that our only option would have been the 60B. By the time we found it out, we had no option, and they get away with the conduct.
So is your argument then that whether Claritin was available to collect on at that time is irrelevant to your claim, or is it relevant?
Well, it's relevant only to the extent that had the Berrys known that Clarendon possibly provided coverage at the time, they would not have agreed to accept less than the $195,000 in the settlement agreement, $65,000.
But has anyone litigated yet the issue of whether Clarendon did or did not owe? Because presumably if Clarendon is able to establish that there was no coverage, where's your fraud claim?
Well, our fraud claim is based upon the conduct from the appellants in this case that they didn't disclose that the Clarendon policy may have applied.
And they say they didn't disclose it because they didn't think it covered.
Well, that's a genuine issue of material fact. That's an issue for the trier fact to decide. We have an expert opinion who clearly indicates it was reasonable for the Berrys to rely upon the representations that only Legion existed.
So you're arguing that if you can prove that they didn't disclose it because they didn't think they had coverage, and it ends up they didn't have coverage, you could still recover.
I don't think it really matters, Your Honor, quite frankly with you.
Why wouldn't it matter? You're recovering for something
the alleged fraud is that they didn't disclose in their answer to interrogatories all the insurance policies that may apply, and it's even more egregious when we come to October of 2001 when they amend their answer to the interrogatory asking that they identify each and every policy that may apply. They don't indicate Clarendon Insurance at all. That very same day, their attorney is sending a letter to Clarendon Insurance saying, we believe there may be coverage.
You still have to show a causation between their misrepresentation and your damages, would you not?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You still have to show a causation between the alleged misrepresentation and your damages?
We have established that it was reasonable for the Berrys to rely upon their kind.
And but for that misrepresentation, you would have been able to recover.
Right. They wouldn't be able to recover, not the $195,000, they wouldn't be able to recover more than the $65,000.
Oh, so it does matter whether Clarendon actually had coverage or not, because that you have to prove damages.
Our damages are the difference between the $65,000 and the $195,000.
You would have only gotten $195,000 if you could have collected from Clarendon.
Correct.
So it does matter.
We're claiming we should have gotten $195,000 based on the initial settlement agreement when they disclosed only the Legion policy.
I assume that's an issue for another day, though.
That's correct. That's correct. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Greco. Mr. Sinnenberg, 30 seconds.
Thank you. Justice Stratton and Justice Cupp, I think you hit the nail. Clarendon would have never been held responsible because there was no claims made during the pertinent policy period. So there would, even in a fraud claim, there would be no damages that would flow to the plaintiffs in this case because Clarendon would never have to cover.
I'm sorry to interrupt again, but that's pretty fact-specific to this case.
Yes,
and as the Justice
that's
said,
true.
We want to come up with a broader rule
I agree.
So if we assume that Clarendon would have been able to pay,
okay,
the issue is still the same, the legal issue.
Correct. But the public policy is still the same. Two things. Number one, the stare decisis doctrine that applies to the Pickle Miser line of cases still is what we has to be relied on. And number two, as Justice Pfeiffer talked about, there has to be some finality. And he alluded to the fact that lots of cases are missed because somebody didn't file in time, just like it wasn't done in this case. And while people are prejudiced by that, people have to rely in our state upon some finality of judgments. And in this case, 60B provides that finality, and that's what we would think would be the appropriate way in which to proceed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Sinnenberg.